Welcome everyone, and thank you for joining today's webinar, The New Normal, How to Be Audit Ready All the Time. My name is Chase and I will be moderating the session today. I would like to introduce today's speakers. First, we have Melanie Newman. Melanie is the President and Global Food Safety Attorney of Newman Risk Services, a food law firm that helps companies manage various risks where law, food safety, food science, and the brand intersect. Melanie has over 18 years of experience advising food and beverage companies, most recently as Executive Vice President and partner with the Atchison Group. Welcome, Melanie, and thank you for joining us today. In addition to Melanie, we have Laura Nelson with us. Laura is Vice President of Business Development here at Alchemy and brings over 30 years of experience implementing food safety and quality control programs for processing, packaging, food service, and retail operations. Laura has worked with global retailers and manufacturers in the implementation of their food and workplace safety programs. Again, welcome Melanie and Laura. On today's presentation, Melanie will walk us through the risks and regulations, and she will share key strategies on how to reduce your risk. Then Laura will discuss how to leverage various technologies to help drive these efficiencies. With that, I will hand it over to Melanie to get us started. Again, thank you for everyone for taking time to present today. And with no further ado, I will turn it over to Melanie.
Thank you, Chase, for that kind introduction, and thanks everyone for joining us today. I think a lot of you probably joined us because you do have that unfortunate realization that the stakes really have gone up. With respect to liability, with respect to just the risk and the nature of the game changing. So that's what we're going to talk about today. We really are going to really take a look at and try to understand that, you know, most of the food industry is undergoing a lot of change, more so than we've seen in decades. And this isn't just because of regulations like the Food Safety Modernization Act. And for example, if you're USDA-regulated performance standards and a host of other regulations that hit the USDA-regulated world, it's also because of increased legal liability risks as well, just with respect and associated with making food today. So we'll talk about that and the risks associated with that. We also get a lot of questions, too, today with regard to those who are regulated by FDA and the new rules coming out under FSMA with respect to, hey, I'm GFSI certified, how do I stack up? How does a GFSI certified scheme measure up to these new FSMA requirements? If I have a GFSI compliant food safety plan, where does that get me with respect to needing to have a FSMA food safety plan come either this September or next September, or possibly, if I'm very small, the following, depending upon my size and my compliance date. So we'll take a look at that with respect to where those GFSI standards measure up. And then lastly, you know, taking a look at what can I do? What are some of the key strategies that some industry-leading companies are employing to stay audit ready? And quite frankly, folks, this last point is really key because this really is what we're talking about today. It is ultimately what we call the new normal. It's being audit ready all the time. I think gone are the days where we can prepare for an audit. We can get the memo that our audit's 2-3 weeks away, and we can wait until, you know, the week before or the few days before or maybe a couple hours before and start cleaning up the place and getting ready for that audit, because audits are going to be more often. They're going to be unannounced. They're going to be unannounced by the regulators. And we can't afford to trip up because the stakes are higher, and we're going to understand when and where and in what capacity the stakes really have been raised. So what has changed? The whole risk landscape has changed, not just regulations. We have got the savvy consumer who is so much more educated, demanding so much more information. They want everything labeled. They want to walk up with a smartphone, scan a QR code, and understand where all of their ingredients came from. And, you know, if it happens to be a protein that comes from an animal, understand what farm it came from. and possibly even the animal's name. I mean, we really are in an era of a real heightened increased demand from the consumer itself, not to mention the consumers, our customers. I mean, if you're listening in from any sort of a mid-size or a large company, you know darn well that your customers are setting the real expectations and the bar. The regulations truly are your minimum regulatory compliance. Those are your minimum standards. Those are the floor. The customers are really setting the ceiling of expectations. The risk of the global food supply, I can't talk to you enough about. There's a whole subsection in a rule of FSMA that explains why it's so important and that we have to control it under certain circumstances. When a hazard is so significant, we have to put a supply chain control in place. We see it all the time. We see recalls that are caused by suppliers in our supply chain. A lot of us had supplier control programs in place anyways for years prior to a regulation telling us we had to do it. Why? Because it's good business practice. But that just illustrates how important controlling our global food supply and our suppliers and really having that visibility, that traceability into our supply chain, understanding where that food comes from, and not only that, but really understanding the true risk. What's my true risk of dealing with that supplier? What's the true risk of that inherent product risk that that supplier is sending me? I may have a very low risk supplier because their practices are good, their behavior is good, they have not had any non-compliances with me, but the inherent risk of that product they supply me, that will always be high. So I need to understand those variables and take a look at that. And we're, as an industry, on par as a whole, maybe haven't been getting an A-plus in that category because we've been maybe looking more just at supplier behavior and not necessarily at the inherent product risk profile. So that's what a lot of companies are taking a better look at now that, you know, they are getting a little more savvy, taking a look at these rules and really understanding, especially those who've gotten burned, at where they've gotten burned, to say, you need to do a better job at peeling back the onion and doing a better risk assessment. But we've also got risks in the media. Boy, media thinks food recalls are sexy. They're all over the news. We see them all the time. If we don't have a media and a social media monitoring program with regard to our food safety risk management programs and our product recalls, don't let your brand be next. We've got to have a strategy to watch it. So we've got risk coming at us at all angles that if we don't have an enterprise risk management approach and strategy to manage these risks, we might just get caught flat-footed. So let's not have that happen to us. When it comes to legal liability stakes and the feeling and the presumption, and when we look around and we hear about folks like Jensen Farms and other types of cases where we've seen prosecutions, and a lot of folks come to me and ask, well, what is the legal standard? What am I being measured by? That's a fantastic question, because a lot of companies and a lot of people say, well, it must be FSMA. It must be the Food Safety Modernization Act that gave FDA or the Department of Justice, the DOJ, these additional rights to come get me. And it isn't. The legal standard, strict liability, and this is a civil tort law standard that's been in existence for pretty much ever since we've been, you know, pretty much alive. This is a tort law liability standard that basically says that no negligence or knowledge is required. If your product left your control from your manufacturing environment and the defect was caused there in your control, and you caused an injury or an illness, there's automatic responsibility. So no knowledge, no negligence is needed. That's why it's called strict liability. And so a derivative of that is called the Park Doctrine. This is a doctrine that was born in 1975, and it really has been laying dormant until recently. And so I think a lot of folks think this is why FSMA was the reason a lot of these recent investigations and charges have been brought, But the PERC doctrine's been around a heck of a long time. But it allows the government to seek a criminal misdemeanor conviction or charge against a company official for violations of the Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act. Again, no knowledge, no negligence. They don't have to even be aware of a violation. The government only needs to prove that the official was in a position of authority or responsibility to have done something about it, to correct that violation. So basically, since 2010, FDA said it would increase the misdemeanor prosecutions of food industry executives for violating the Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act. So this PERC doctrine is wakening up. It is flying now. This PERC doctrine was leveraged in the Jensen Farms cantaloupe listeria case, for example. So this isn't, you know, Melanie Newman trying to lay a scare tactic on anyone. It's really trying to awaken the industry to say there are higher stakes now. The hurdles have been raised. So documentation, record keeping, training, awareness levels really become important now, because this PERC doctrine, as you will see, can start to be leveraged not only in companies but also third parties. And we'll get a little bit more into that in a moment here. But ultimately, what gets us in trouble? What's the standard? And it goes back to the 1938 Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act. It's adulteration. We have to still be looking out for what we've always looked out for, even before FSMA. And it's, if that food has been processed, packed, or prepared under insanitary conditions, or if it bears basically the act language, if it bears or contains any poisonous or deleterious substance that may render it injurious to health. That means if you make someone sick or you injure someone, that human illness standard, if you have a foodborne illness outbreak that makes someone sick, FDA is coming in, ergo the white coat, and guess what? So is the Department of Justice, the black coat. So stakes have changed when we think about this, right? The bar has been raised. Well, we're used to the white coats coming in when that happens, but are we really used to the black coats coming in? Probably not. And we'll talk about that in a moment here, too, where the assistant attorney, deputy attorney general, has gone on record stating they are moving in, they are coming in. And the penalties for violations of the Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act, they are what they always have been. They're called prohibited acts. A prohibited act is a violation of the act. And really the ultimate question is, how severe is it? Is it intentional? Is it willful? On the scale of severity, should the DOJ be bringing civil or criminal charges? And criminal violations look like any other criminal violation. It's either felony or misdemeanor. A felony charge, typically that is going to involve intent to defraud or mislead. That can entail more than a year in jail, usually numerous years in jail, and up to millions of dollars in fines or both. Typically this fine is going to be over $250,000. Criminal misdemeanor charges does not require any intent to defraud. This is where we go back to that strict liability standard. A person can be convicted if they're in a position of authority or responsibility that they could have done something about it to prevent that violation. Take that in. When we think about the case of PCA, the Peanut Corporation of America, does the name Mary Wilkerson come to mind? A QA manager who is now serving 5 years in prison. We'll get to her in a moment. But up to $250,000 of a fine and up to 1 year in prison when you don't even know what's happening. But if you're in a position of authority or responsibility, that could happen. So the hurdle's getting higher. And here comes the Department of Justice, forging an alliance with the FDA, where Principal Deputy Assistant Attorney General Benjamin Meiser says, We have to rely on the companies who manufacture and distribute the food to ensure that it's safe. Okay, I get that. But he states himself that consumers give little thought to food safety and that he doesn't either. And the role to protect consumer safety is at its apex when consumers can't protect themselves. So as a result, the Department of Justice is committed to vigorously prosecuting food safety cases. This was just in April of this year. And a lot of folks ask me, you know, do you think they'll back off? Do you think this will change with the presidential elections, the administration changing over? And I don't. And here's a couple reasons why. The consumer advocacy groups that were behind FSMA, they're not going anywhere. The congressmen and women and the senators who were behind the push for FSMA, they're not going anywhere that represent those consumer advocacy groups. It's now law. It's really hard to overturn a law. So I really don't think this sentiment is going anywhere but staying put and potentially growing stronger. I know there are a few skeptics out there who are probably looking much like this gentleman here saying, really, what are the chances this will happen? And the reality is investigations and charges have been brought, and they continue to be brought, and against some cases that were unintentional contamination and some cases that were intentional contamination. So before 2006 and 2007, we didn't hear about salmonella and peanut butter because as an industry, we weren't aware that salmonella could survive in low moisture foods, right? Now we know. So now that's a known or reasonably foreseeable risk in a hazard analysis, right? But before then, it wasn't. But some companies had recalls due to moisture entering the environment, getting into the food, and boom, perfect storm. It was a salmonella wildfire, and salmonella grew, and recalls occurred, and illnesses occurred. And years later, Department of Justice investigation and charges, settlements of millions of dollars against major peanut butter manufacturers. Over, you know, $11 million in a settlement, for example. Completely unintentional contamination in that case. You compare that to then you move to the Jensen Farms recall, Listeria and cantaloupe. First time we saw Listeria on a whole fruit, uncut fruit like that. Now, they repurposed a potato washer and didn't use any chlorinated spray or an antibacterial wash. They used a third-party audit firm to audit them, didn't catch certain practices they should have. The Park Doctrine was revived and used in this case, criminal misdemeanor charges against them. They got $150,000, the Jensen brothers did, in restitution fines and 6 months home detention. Now, in the Jensen Farms case, 33 people died, many, many illnesses. Now, in one of the first peanut butter recalls, several people became ill, and that was unfortunate, but no one died. An 11-some million-dollar Department of Justice settlement. And 33 people died in Jensen Farms, and they got $150,000 in restitution. Pretty skewed, huh? Pretty interesting. Now, the Park Doctrine can be leveraged against third parties. So in that case, that established that the Park Doctrine can be established against third-party audit firms, third-party auditors. So it's a whole new stake. It's a whole new game where there is the ante has been upped with respect to liability and with respect to making, producing, and being a part of this food space, even including third-party auditors. Moving to Peanut Corporation of America, I mentioned the name Mary Wilkerson before. Now, her bosses, the CEO, for example, got 28 years in prison. His brother, Mike Parnell, got 20 years in prison. No, they're not cellmates, by the way. They're in two separate prisons, fairly enough, I might add. They committed obstruction of justice, you know, wire fraud, conspiracy. They changed positive salmonella results, lab results, to negative. I mean, very willful case here, by the way. So, was the verdict, if you will, commensurate and fair in this, you know, case? Many would argue absolutely, given the gravity of what they did. They shipped positive salmonella containing product out to the marketplace, and a lot of people got ill and died. But Mary Wilkerson, QA manager, position of responsibility and authority to have prevented the violation and didn't. Scary, huh? A lot of us wonder in the food industry why we can't find good young people coming up in the programs and in our facilities. Might be one area of why. Now, in this particular case, Mary, when asked by FDA and by DOJ, when asked certain questions, she wasn't all that straightforward, let's put it that way. So there was an obstruction of justice issue going on there as well. So it's very important to be to be upfront about your answers when being interviewed. That's first and foremost. But these cases are real. These cases are happening. They're happening a lot. They're happening daily. So don't think that this is just a talk. These are real stakes occurring. So this gives you some ammunition to help get systems, help get new policies, new people, get this information to the right people, because FDA's approach is changing. They're changing their titles from inspectors to investigators. They gave a PCQI training course to a group of folks that were, it was a half FDA course, half public course, and their titles are changing to that. So you can draw what conclusion you would like, but FDA is looking for food safety culture as well. So the question becomes, are you? They've determined and developed ways to look for that, ways to measure it, metrics to measure that as well. But ultimately, what is FDA really looking for when they come into your facilities to investigate or inspect you, however you want to look at it or call it? They're really looking to determine, are you going to be FSMA ready? Are you going to be audit ready? Do you have your food safety plan? Have you identified your known and reasonably foreseeable hazards with preventive controls? Are you going to be able to manage those appropriately? You know, and the your other risks with GMPs or your PRP programs. Because if not, if your food safety plans and testing and records and your GMPs aren't reflecting a sound program, they're moving in. Quote. So where does FSMA fit in? It gives us more opportunity to trip up and commit a prohibited act. And this is just a friendly reminder of what needs to be in your food safety plan and where we can trip up. And each one of these steps requires numerous records, numerous documents, and numerous points at which we need to train. We need to train our personnel and record and document that training. And how are we going to manage all of that? So turning to the point where we ask ourselves and say to ourselves, well, I should be good. I've got a GFSI certification. I have a GFSI compliant food safety plan. I have training requirements under my GFSI certified food safety plan. How does this all measure up? It's a fantastic question, and I give a heck of a lot of kudos to the GFSI organization itself. They themselves underwent a comparative analysis with their benchmarked standards to the FSMA preventive controls rules and a couple of other rules, as well as numerous of the GFSI schemes also commissioned their own comparative analyses against several different GFSI rules, all of which have done the preventive controls for human food rule. And this is just a quick kind of rundown of the high-level analysis and kind of where they stacked up. I had the pleasure and the privilege of doing almost all of them or being a part of almost all of them. And ultimately, this is just kind of what the analysis structure looked like. It really was just looking for whether a FSMA rule section addressed a GFSI scheme standard requirement and to point out any major requirement of FSMA if that was missing from a GFSI scheme standard. And we rated it either exceeds, comparable, or different. So if a GFSI scheme clause exceeded a FSMA expectation, if they were comparable to one another, and then the different meant that if a GFSI scheme clause was either not as prescriptive, detailed, or stringent as the corresponding FSMA rule requirement, or asked something fundamentally different. So here was a common theme amongst all of them. It was this need for the PCQI, that preventive control qualified individual, which also, as we all know, involves a heavy training element to it, or, you know, in most cases should if we're not trying to prove it out through experience, for example. So as we know, in the GFSI benchmark and all of the schemes, theirs is a very HACCP team approach in GFSI, or a HACCP manager, HACCP coordinator, but it can be a very team approach. The PCQI is a very individual approach in FSMA. So we've got this, also we have this requirement of what's now known as the food safety plan versus the HACCP plan. And HACCP is very based on codex principles, internationally founded principles, and the food safety plan is clearly based on a U.S.-centric law known as the Preventive Control Rule for Humans under FDA. So here we have a bit of this conundrum that GFSI is meant to be a global standard, right? You're able to roll it out, implement it in a facility in Idaho or India, and it's meant to be globally applied and global in nature. And that's why HACCP had been, you know, pretty appealing, because that is also based on codex and it's generally pretty internationally applicable. So the challenge is FSMA is a U.S. regulation, GFSI is global. So, you know, how will the schemes handle this? They're all, you know, debating this or, you know, discussing this, I should say, and I don't have the answers to this, but what I do think will happen is that, you know, HACCP will likely hang around via requirement. A lot of companies are dual naming their programs HACCP/food safety plan for these very reasons, that it has to be globally applied. The practical implementation of needing this, quote, plan, it needs to work globally. So these are kind of, you know, some of the global themes that we're seeing with respect to that potential struggle that is going to come to light. You know, FSMA also has some new training requirements as well that differs from GFSI training requirements. And again, it goes back to this bit of, you know, revelation of this being a U.S. law versus GFSI needing to be global in nature. So we have the preventive control qualified individual and the qualified individual definitions under this U.S. law that has certain definitions to them. I won't read you these definitions here, but again, you're going to see an inherent and likely, you know, it makes sense, but a bit of a disconnect. You're not going to see these exact same definitions in your GFSI scheme requirements because they're meant to be global. What you will see in your GFSI scheme requirements is the expectation that you meet all applicable regulatory requirements in your jurisdiction. So what does that mean? It means you need to meet this. If you're a U.S. facility and or you're a foreign facility shipping into the United States. So you're still achieving it. It's still there. It's just, it's there de facto by needing to meet your applicable regulatory requirements in your relevant jurisdiction. So this is just a reminder of the role of the PCQI, and maybe, you know, you want to take a look at the role of the PCQI and the role that it, the, that person serves, and compare that against your HACCP manager, your HACCP coordinator, and your either your SQF practitioner or whatever GFSI deemed certified person in that role, just to see, you know, is there any disconnect? Do I need to make sure that all functions are fulfilled in these two capacities? So if you're GFSI certified, you're almost home, but you still got to hustle to home plate, just so that you make sure that you're not out. FDA has gone on record saying GFSI food compliance plans could be sufficient, but you still need to lay the requirements of the rule against them to ensure that you have everything. So GFSI schemes exceed in many areas. This is just a representative example. These are just key areas that I've listed here, very significant, important areas where the GFSI scheme, so this could be multiple different schemes. This isn't just the GFSI benchmark standard. These are multiple of the different schemes as well. You know, very, very important areas. For example, you know, internal audit and the senior management involvement, they're very critical areas. Outsourcing to co-manufacturers, very important areas to be able to control and manage your risk. Where does FSMA appear to exceed? There weren't a lot of areas where FSMA appeared to exceed the GFSI scheme requirements, but where they did, it was pretty distinct. It was in pretty key areas that are required in your food safety plan. So please be sure to compare these areas with your any existing plans that you might have and practices and procedures you might have in the areas of corrective action and calibration, for example. The corrective action requirements in FSMA are just, they're just a little bit more prescriptive, more detailed in certain areas. So when these slides become available to you, please feel free to check this out. And for example, each of many of the GFSI scheme owners who did commission these analyses, a lot of them do have these available to their facilities who are certified under them. So reach out to them and see if you can get a copy so that you can see some of this as well relevant to your particular GFSI certified scheme. Calibration, again, it's just more prescriptive. So it's not like these topics are missing in your GFSI certified program. It's just that FSMA has a little bit more detail or prescriptiveness to them. The same goes for the documentation, process validation, and training. So the preventive controls rule has some very detailed guidelines for when process controls need to be validated. That's just another example of the prescriptiveness, or the level of detail goes beyond the level of detail in some of these GFSI standards. So how do I reduce my risk? I'm going to end on this slide just for purposes of time to make sure that my great colleague Laura has plenty of time here to get through her wonderful material as well. But here is what I want to leave you with, and I might have time for one more slide, but have an inspection policy. Oh goodness, make sure your people are prepared for when your regulators show up at your facility doorsteps. Empower them, prepare them for what they're supposed to say. The policy on photographs, policy on swabs, escorting the inspectors to, you know, to the conference rooms, everything like that. And know your duties. I can't tell you folks how many clients of mine still unfortunately don't either remember, and I think it's just a matter of remembering, because when we're in the throes of a crisis, sometimes our brains just shut off. But we have to remember about that reportable food registry, that RFR acronym there, of when we need to report and what the triggers are under that when we need to report a reportable food registry event. In our duty to test, now we have environmental monitoring program requirements when we've got a ready-to-eat food that's exposed to the environment post-processing and prior to packaging. got to do it. The rule says we got to do it. And know your playbook. Know the laws. Know the standards. Know the players. Go have a meeting with your regulator. Know them in a time of calm versus a time of chaos. Have them understand your production, you know, your production environment, the types of products you make, any uniqueness about you, so that you don't have to get them up to speed in the time of chaos. And really understand that kind of, you know, nuanced consumer you have, and how fickle that they can be, so that you can plan a communication strategy for them if you happen to have a recall. Really know your suppliers. They and your co-manufacturers are brand ambassadors for you, whether you like it or not. So the more you can understand their practices, procedures, and how they manage your risk for you, the better off you will be. Keep scorecards. Boy, that is the nature of the game. If you really want to be able to block and tackle, really understand who's passing, who's not. Sit down with them if their non-compliance rates are going off the charts, and have some consequences. Cut them off the team if they're not performing and bucking up. Because that's a sign of a food safety culture. If you know you have 19 non-conformances in a year, and you're just like, we'll just let the 20th go by too. And really leverage technology to manage your risks where you can. With all of these documents and record-keeping requirements under these new rules, I don't know how people are going to manage without leveraging technology. And to the extent and where you can really create that food safety culture, you know, from the top down if possible, but if you see something, say something, do something, and develop that consistency of that food safety culture, so we're able to really, you know, generate a place where people really want to be, and all of a sudden the metrics will really prove themselves out. So I think with that, I'm going to turn my time back over to Laura Nelson from Alchemy, who is a wonderful professional colleague and, dare I say, a great friend as well. So thank you, everybody.
Thanks, Melanie. Gosh, you've given us a lot to think about. Really appreciate your great insight on the integration points for the current HACCP programs, GFSI schemes, and FSMA regulations. So triangulating all of those is clearly, and assimilating that is really going to be necessary for us to develop the appropriate processes and protocols to achieve that unified food safety plan. So, you know, when all of those parts are in place that you described, Melanie, this well-oiled machine is really going to be able to deliver not only high audit scores, but it's going to provide us more efficiency and productivity in our operations, and the nice thing about that is it allows us to grow and develop happy customers. But all of those things have to be working together. So all of our GMP programs, our sanitation, food defense, all of those things have to be working together. And our workforce is the common denominator for the execution of all those programs and procedures. You know, we're all clear that each of our employees must understand their role in food safety and consistently deliver the appropriate behaviors, really, to support the plant's food safety plan. So effective training and education are the oils that keep our systems running and helps us reduce our risk. So today I'm going to talk about the three keys to optimizing our workforce. The truth is, you know, despite our best intentions around training and educating our employees, we still have those employees that are failing to follow our food safety procedures. So what I'd like to do is cover three keys, something to give you some thought to think about and challenge you in looking at your program, your training programs, to see how you can best achieve this audit readiness. So first, I'd like to explore the alignment of training content with critical food safety risk, so a different way of looking at training. Second, let's discuss the importance of providing your employees the tools that they need. Seems pretty obvious, but I'd like to suggest a couple of things that we can do to address some gaps there. And last, let's explore the importance of empowering your frontline supervisors. And, you know, this is a theme that we have. I think those frontline supervisors are overlooked, and we're going to talk about that in a little more detail. For the fourth year in a row, we've conducted a global food safety training survey with Camden, the survey is really designed to be a benchmark for companies like all of you to see where you stand as compared to your global peers. We asked a lot of different questions around food safety, what you're training, how often you train, the topics that you're training. And so if you're interested in this survey, just send a chat notice and we can send that to you. We've had a lot of interest over the last 4 years in really looking at that, and people have been able to leverage that data to maybe help them be more towards the average if they're kind of needing some support, internal support. One of the questions we asked around food safety training is how the value of training is measured. And you can see here that the top three upwards of the top three are product quality, so complaints, food safety recalls and withdrawals, and on-hold products. And I don't know, if you step back and look at that, those are all lagging indicators. That's after the fact. Something happened and we're notified, and so we've got issues, and so now we're going back trying to replay what happened, who dropped the ball, or what processes were missed. If you look at the number two, the employee performance behavior, 55% of the responders are measuring employee performance or behaviors, and that's a leading indicator. So I'd like to just have you focus on that. By really focusing on that particular metric, plants can then be proactive in their corrective actions and behavior optimization. So clearly something to think about as you're looking at ways to measure training. Our first key then is to connect behaviors to process outcomes. So let's use proper sanitation as an example. We're all of us are providing some really great training on sanitation, right? What chemicals is used in the plant, methods of application, etc. But let's consider the value of extending that knowledge and training our employees to continually identify those conditions that challenge proper sanitation. So what do I mean by that? Well, what if employees understood not only the process of sanitation and conditions in which bacteria grow, but what if they were our eyes and ears, and they were constantly looking for those areas that could possibly present us some risk. So looking for the crimped equipment, barrels that might harbor bacteria, looking for those leaky hoses and being proactive in identifying those, helping us identify pooled water or damaged drains, always being looking for those things that affect or create issues in proper sanitation. So I guess the challenge here is look for opportunities to train employees to bring attention to the issues like proper sanitation, and let's provide an extra level of documentation for those that are doing that, so are providing those behaviors, they're identifying those things, and those behaviors can be tracked and measured. And so I think if you see where we're moving into more a preventative approach than simply being more reactive. And that's going to deliver a lot of value. Another question from our Global Food Safety Survey included sharing the types of training deficiencies noted during the audit. So I think if you look at this, you can see that across the board, we really struggle with finding time and resources to train our employees, to give them the appropriate refreshers, to validate their understanding of the training, and make sure that they have the specific skills necessary to perform their job task. I know, Melanie, you and I were talking about, for example, call centers, people that are taking complaints from customers, and how these people are often times overlooked in training when we're looking at our training metrics and we're thinking, okay, we're going to train these folks on sanitation and HACCP and these folks on food defense. Those call centers sometimes are people that get missed, and maintenance folks sometimes get missed. So we need to make sure that we're addressing those. The reality, I think, on this is that we may not be doing the job that we think we're doing. Alchemy partnered with the Center for Research and Public Policy, and we conducted a survey of the food workers and the supervisors and management. And we received a lot of great feedback. And again, if you're interested in this study, we can certainly send that to you. Almost 20% of employees are reported that they received too little onboarding training. And clearly, if they don't understand what they need to do as they're getting started, that's certainly introducing risk in our organization. If they can't execute on our programs from the beginning, then we've got some challenges. A little over 37% of workers and 42% of supervisors shared that the training that they received is really too complex. It's difficult to understand. So we're spending the time and the effort to do the training, but the reality is that time might not be well spent. And it appears that the hard-fought time we do allocate, it's really not delivering the comprehension and the behaviors that we expect. So our second key is really to provide employees with the tools they need to do their job adequately. So we need to embrace this opportunity to take a really close look at our training programs to see how we can improve it and make it more effective. So I've just got a few points here to kind of get us started thinking about these. And I just like to challenge you. You may not have issues in all of these areas, but one or two of them you might want to explore and see how you can address. Instead of training all your employees on a kind of a static set of topics, it's really important to create those learning plans that are very job specific, so they have the knowledge for the task that they're going to execute on. So if you're giving a broad approach and having everybody trained on everything and not drilling down to the specific things that people need, what we're finding is that people don't really understand how to apply it, or again, it's not enough, as we've just seen on the data, to help them execute on a daily basis. So what we're finding with progressive folks is that they're creating very, very specific learning plans based on the job task and even the equipment that a specific employee is working with. And by checking people off on their role, the accountability, and their proficiency, then people are able to elevate the performance of those employees. The other thing is when. So 15 to 20 minute training events, and I was tempted to put 2 to 5 minutes on there, because we're seeing that training events need to be shrinking in time, not only because we're challenged in making time for training, but honestly, we can't hold the attention of our employees for very long. And yet, we have still have folks that are trying to do the one and done data training dump, pulling everybody in and having an all-day Saturday training event where you're hitting the food safety, workplace safety, HR, processing. It's just too much. People don't remember that information, and if they don't remember, then it's not a value of time. So we're really looking at, there's lots of technology. We offer that technology to really develop very short modules. We have some refresher training that's up to 5 minutes, 4 or 5 minutes, to really address, if they already know the information, they've been a senior employee for several years, then we're just wanting to validate that they still understand those key elements. If they're a new employee, then let's build on short training events versus trying to get it all done at one time. And, you know, I think when we talk about training, a lot of us think about classroom training. We think about in front of the computer, that's where training takes place, and we check off the box, and we're off and running. The reality is there is a lot of training going on the plant floor. Our peers are training each other on the plant floor, and the thing we have to ask ourselves is how consistent is that training? How much does that match what we are training in the classroom? Are they reinforcing the folks that are out there on the plant floor what needs to be done? Or are there some shortcuts and bad habits that's being portrayed and projected that is going counter to what we've trained people on? So what we do find is some companies out there are creating mentoring programs so that a new newly hired employee is mentored by someone, and all of that training is being monitored so that we know for sure that that's being reinforced. And obviously supervisors are reinforcing the training that was done in the classroom out in the plant floor. We know that many learners are kinesthetic learners, that they're doers, and so that they don't learn by watching or hearing training necessarily. They need to go out and actually do the job. And so that's those folks that we need to help manage and realize that they're doing their learning out on the plant floor. And we have to make sure that we extend our training program to accommodate that kind of learner. And then we talk about whys. Explaining the negatives outcomes from employee perspective. I think sometimes we build our training and we like to put a bunch of stats in. Here's how many people died from food poisoning. It's really important that we do things right. And an employee has a hard time wrapping around what it means to them. But if you translate that to companies that have been involved in an investigation, been involved in recalls like Melanie was talking about, then now we're it's people that are out of jobs, people that no longer have the income. Customers drop them, and so we have to lay off personnel. So all of a sudden now those outcomes are very specific to an employee perspective. So we need to build that in into our training and make sure we're telling employees what it really means to them. And then the how. And again, you think about classroom training, instructor-led training, ILT. What we're finding is that alone is not going to drive the behaviors you want. And there's all kinds of data to suggest that, and we'll talk about that in a minute. So people are using huddle talks, prescribed huddle talks, awareness programs, posters, digital signage. It's in multiple languages, very visual. So if you we have people saying, well, gosh, I just don't have time, Laura, to do any more training. Well, think about putting digital signage in that doesn't require specific training, but that's going to impact and provide the awareness that's needed to drive some of these important food safety programs and procedures that Melanie talked about. So we have awareness programs that we put together and provide a lot of this kind of thing. There's all kinds of people that are doing some really creative things around it. But clearly, just understanding that you're only going to get so much bang for the classroom training. I'll just leave that with this slide. I think it's a great slide. So having the knowledge and having the tools and equipment, I was auditing a plant, and I noted that people weren't using soap, and the QA manager was so puzzled, they could not figure out. He said, I'm seeing the same thing you all are, Laura. I have no idea why they're not using soap. And I asked an employee as he were walking by during shift change, I said, hey, how come you're not using soap? And they said, because there is no soap, it's empty. And I think that that's part of what we talk about is engaging those employees, and it goes beyond it, that one-directional communication, but really building an engagement where we're asking employees, hey, this is important, help us understand and execute that, and if you're having issues, let's find a way to overcome them. So I guess with that, I would leave it that certainly talking with Melanie, the technology is very important, time is money, and trying to address all of these regulations is a handful. So there's lots of resources out there, and I encourage everyone to explore those. Melanie?
I just echo Laura's great comments. Leverage your technology to manage your risk. It's a new risk ball game out there, so be ready to play ball.
Terrific. Couple of plugs here. We have our next upcoming webinar will be on July 20th around food fraud. We highly recommend everybody take a moment to participate in that. And then as a follow-up to Melanie's earlier comments, Alchemy is offering a PCQI course that will, it's a two and a half day course taught by our professional services group. It's a wonderful course, and we'll get you that certificate of completion that you can use as part of your auditing processes for the new preventative control rules. All of those details can be found on our website. Again, Melanie and Laura, thank you so much for taking the time to provide such wonderful information. And for everyone who participated in today's webinar, we very much appreciate your participation. And most importantly, we really appreciate your feedback. You will be prompted with a survey as you exit this week. We highly encourage you to take the time to fill that out and provide us feedback and let us know if you'd like to hear from us or hear more about Alchemy products. Quick recap for all of those who submitted questions, we will be following up with you after the webinar to provide answers to those questions. Again, thank you everyone for taking the time to join us today, and we hope you have a wonderful rest of your afternoon. Take care.